Could you have overinvestment across all?
Across all.
Yeah. Actually, you know, that question would get you different answers depending on whether you read Hayek or Mises. It's Mises who does argue that there can, in fact, he says even overconsumption, which is excessive use of resources, even at the final stage. All right, on top of that, superimposed on top of that, is a relative misallocation. So what I would argue, and do argue in Time and Money, that you get both, that you get an increase in investment all around that's very temporary, or that's inherently temporary, and at the same time, a pattern of investment that actually pulls the Hayekian triangle at both ends against the middle. You get excessive consumption as identified by Mises, and you get excessive investment in the long-term sectors, as recognized by both Mises and Hayek. Okay, so I would say you get both, and I would say that the market mechanisms that bring the boom to an end are very critically tied up with the malinvestment aspect. Because if you think about it, what's happening, and again I'll go back to Frank Shostak's pool of funding. At the very time the pool is being drained by consumers, investors are setting off on a course that would require a larger pool. Okay, and so as that process moves forward, and as stages of production in the intermediate range mature to fruition, the consumable output simply isn't as great, and so at that point consumption has to be reduced. In fact, that's the reduction in consumption that I think is best described by the term forced saving, okay, which is integral to most all the Austrian accounts of the business cycle.
And Professor Stromberg, you mentioned that bad policy begets bad policies.
Mm-hmm.
I've heard this question before, but why doesn't that inevitably lead to the U.S. being some sort of Marxian utopia? There's some cultural constraint that, you know, bad policy eventually leads to good policy.
Well, no, not really. I'd like someone to guarantee me that we're not turning into a Marxist utopia, first of all. But okay, with a certain gradualism, I suppose. But if you read certain publications, including some of them claim to be conservative, you find a certain wholesale adoption of themes that used to be those of the Marxists and so forth. So,
neoconservative is a socialist.
Yeah, I think that's fair enough. In several senses, but it may be partly that it's cumulative. One, intellectual error can just apparently persist for quite a long time, but it's not just that. It means once the process has gone on long enough, you've got a whole class of entrenched people who believe this, but it's also in their interest to have other people believe this. And when these people, in effect, nationalize the educational system of an entire country and create the predominant paradigms that you get from first grade through the universities, and they also have an interest in perpetuating these views, it becomes very difficult for anybody to sort of think their way out of the paper bag. And also, again, and it's also partly maybe just a kind of logistical problem that it's much simpler for a few sugar producers to go to Tallahassee or send lobbyists to Tallahassee to figure out some way to raise the price of sugar than it would be for all the sugar buyers in Florida to organize themselves to save that couple of cents. And it's just a few pennies on the dollar for the single consumer, but it means a lot to the guys who send the lobbyists. So there's a sort of a structural problem that I suppose it's analogous to the so-called public goods and free rider problems, but it's another story.
Let me add something. I think Mises' explanation of this has to do with the notion that we tend to lose freedom gradually. Okay, you tend not to see a society that's moving gradually towards freedom. Okay, it takes something more momentous to get back some freedom. But you move towards away from freedom gradually. I've heard it called the potato chip theory of regulation. You can't eat just one. You can't impose just one.
In the back?
Yeah.
Joe, this is sort of a sidelight to your talk, but I was curious, maybe the other people are. Was charisma the main explanation for Roosevelt's 36th re-election, given that, you know, he hadn't solved the pressing problem that got him elected?
Well, I don't know, I suppose you could say that the Republican Party has a sort of built-in genius for not finding a candidate that's going to persuade anyone. That's always, you always have to allow for that. But yeah, I suppose that the charisma was a big factor. And although I don't know, there were people like John T. Flynn was one who said that he voted for Roosevelt the first time he ran when he appeared to be a Cleveland Democrat, and never voted for him again. And my father did the same thing, voted for him once, and then never again. But apparently some people didn't react badly to the set of policies that were being put in place and voted against him on that basis, but maybe thought this might work. Or maybe he somehow did create this notion that something was being done. And I mean, you've got to remember, they're putting all these people out there with shovels and planting trees, and they've got a lot of activity going, and they're getting a lot of press, and they keep a lot of excitement, and they're slaughtering little pigs to raise the price and all of that. So maybe that was enough.
Can I say this? In that particular election, the campaign sloganeering was very candid and very explicit. That was spend, 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 elect, elect, elect. Okay, got a lot of votes, with or without charisma. Okay, there was people after the election that said, they told me if I voted for Outlander, there'd be more years of depression. And so I did, and there was.
You also remember that Roosevelt took us off prohibition, and that made a lot of people happy as well.
Mm-hmm.
Way back then. Yes, Dr. Garrison, in your article on the classic hierarchy and hangover, you talked about MZM growth. And would you agree with some academics subtracting money market funds from MZM in their calculation of money supply growth?
Quite possibly, but of all of the statistics that are reported routinely by the central bank itself, I tend to look at MZM rather than M1 or the monetary base. I think it's a better indicator.
Here in the middle.
Me?
Yes.
Dr. Garrison, would you comment on the so-called hedonic price adjustments that are used by government statisticians to artificially make productivity and output look better, inflation look better, sort of artificial price adjustments that get a totally irrelevant and incorrect picture of how the U.S. economy has performed over the last 5 years?
Of course, those kind of adjustments are so prone to chicanery and to making the figures say what you want them to say. It's something I don't think is much worth looking at those statistics that tell the story.
I mean, is that simply political chicanery?
It certainly invites it, and it's hard to establish that they've got just the right hedonic price.
And that's institutionalized now, isn't it, in the calculation of the CPI?
Well, in a lot of it, in imputing the value of goods that aren't traded and so on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Want to add one thing about the moral hazard? If I could.
Go ahead.
Yeah. There's now a small literature now. There's articles in the political science journals that have titles like the 4-year presidential business cycle. So the political scientists at least have figured out the way in which that there's an attempt to actually fine-tune fiscal policy to presidential elections. And of course the general public is even beginning to catch on to this, that the president gets in, and if the economy is quote-unquote sluggish, then he'll have Allen do something with the money supply, and then if he's lucky and the timing works out for them, then he'll be reelected while this is still working. Sometimes it doesn't work.
Roger, in your presentation, you tied the unemployment rate with the concept of sustainable growth. Are there other measures in the economy that would track out similarly, or and why do you pick the unemployment rate?
Well, I'm using the unemployment rate just because I think it shows pretty vividly the unsustainable period of growth. But you can also look at long-term capital investments. I mean, in the article that I handed out, the one point we make is that that particular unsustainable boom was certainly characterized by long-term investment. It was an investment boom and an investment bust, and all sorts of businesses who were operating on a current negative cash flow but hoped for profits in the next decade or whatever were the ones that went down, like the dot-coms, for instance. A lot of the dot-coms were jump-started and up and running with negative cash flows and not even anticipating to turn profits for 10 or 12 years. And that's the very kind of activity that you could track to verify the Austrian theory, and that's what we saw in that period.
Is anybody doing any work on trying to actually trace where these monetary injections go and how they go?
It's very difficult doing it on an industry-by-industry or sector-by-sector basis. But essentially, you want to just watch what's happening to interest rates, because that's going to govern what kinds of investment get undertaken in whichever industry happens to be undertaking them. Okay.
Dr. Harrison, one point you didn't raise about Greenspan is bailouts. I think there was Mexico, and then there's Asia, and there's been a series of sort of intervention in the stock market, and then after September 11th, in considering the relationship between political chicanery and intellectual error, how do you account for this aspect of Greenspan's rule?
That's difficult, and a lot of the things he did were very much counter to the whole operation of the Fed or what it's supposed to do. And he was violating even Fed procedures in taking a public stance and using the Federal Reserve to help long-term management funds and that sort of thing.
Yeah, right.
I think it's Greenspan himself, in response to some of Woodward's questioning, likened it to a fire truck going the wrong way down a one-way street to put out a raging fire. Okay, we're not supposed to do it, but hey, to find a worse evil, we'll commit this one.
Okay. Any more questions? Right there in the
middle. That's Dr. Garrison. When you're looking for a definition of malinvestment, is there any reason why it just can't be simply defined as any project whose internal rate of return doesn't return its weighted average cost of capital? As simple as that?
No, it's not quite as simple as that. Because now that might help. I mean, in some cases you might identify some, but with the Austrian theory, what's very critical is that investment projects, as used by Hayek, that term is used by Hayek or Mises or whatever, refer to projects that are seen through several different stages of production and are in the hands at different times of different firms, okay, where outputs of one firm sell as inputs into the next firm. All right, so there's some vertical relationship between the different firms that eventually give rise to consumer goods. And so the internal rate of return that you would have to look at, if you could look at it, would be the rate of return that would apply to the entire project that spans several firms. And those are figures that aren't available. They're not calculated by the individual firms. In fact, they're not within the scope of individual firms to calculate. That's one of the problems. If somehow industry had a way of making those calculations from the outset, they probably wouldn't engage in those activities. Okay.
They would, wouldn't they not? Because they're looking at a false.
Right. The calculations they're making are based on wrong signals. I mean, prices really are signals, and if the signals are distorted, the calculations are going to be wrong. And despite the whole so-called rational expectations revolution, we can't simply assume that just because a firm knows or suspects that a signal is wrong, that he knows what the undistorted signal would be. That information is simply not available. But it may well be that the rate of return, internal rate of return, that's unique to a specific firm is engaged in part of the of the project may show it profitable based on prices that they're facing. Okay, and yet it may be in the end that this project, after it's been sold as output, as input to the next firm, and so on. In the end, the whole thing may turn out to be unprofitable, but there's no way to calculate that in advance.
Okay. No matter what, the weighted average cost of capital that they're looking at is actually low. Is actually higher than it appears to be.
Sure, sure.
Yes, if I could put you both on the spot, could you both provide your GDP forecast for 2002? Make a slide.
Well, I don't think I'll deviate from what Joe Salerno said. I won't put numbers on it, but you know, the pressure of the recession may well bottom out in mid-year of 2002. I won't put any figures on it. So what else might want to? What do you think?
I don't know. I'm just a historian. I'm trying to avoid this kind of prediction. So I'm sorry.
Did you see things happening with this administration and this Congress that we've already tried and we've done before in the past in similar crashes or panics that would lead one to sort of make a guess as to what we have to look forward to in the next 3 to 4 years? Are we making mistakes that we've made before?
Well, sure. They're infinitely replicable or repeatable. They can always make the same mistake again. Up until some point, I guess, that approaches the total collapse of the system or a hyperinflation or something, they can apparently do this over and over without learning a great deal. So that's not a very optimistic answer, I suppose. But
actually, I'm referring more to Congress and policy, not necessarily the Fed.
Well, no, I think I was including Congress. But, I mean, Congress has to vote these bailouts, and the bailouts are going, there's no real chest of money hidden away in the back of the White House to finance the bailouts. I mean, they're going to bail out the insurance industry. They're going to bail out everybody who even knew anybody who was involved in the Twin Towers. It's becoming very large. It's a huge, and then there is the cost of this war or whatever it's being called lately. There's all that. There's this whole, but they love that. You know that you can always sell a military action, and particularly in a situation like this when there's been, you know, an actual terrorist attack. So there's just I'm frankly wondering how they're going to actually be able to exert any of their famous control with the amount of money they're proposing to lay out in all these areas, but perhaps they have acquired some general feeling for how to keep the thing from becoming just a runaway situation. So I don't know. I mean, not only do you have just normal political motivations for pursuing the same bad policies again, now you've also got this added dimension of bailout, world empire, the responsibilities of being the last remaining superpowers. It seems to me it's quite colossal. And in these proposals, we're going to bail out all these other failing economies. There's bound to be some price. I don't know how high it will be. I mean, you know, for the American people, for the American economy, that's something I wish I knew. But I don't know if that directly answered your question. but it seems to me, yeah, H.L. Mencken once said, nobody ever went broke underestimating the intelligence of the American voter. But I would say, nobody ever went broke underestimating the rascality of these people in power. I don't know, there's very few restraints on them other than the danger of possibly not being reelected, and it takes a lot to not be reelected now. So.